This is the third talk of the day. Those who are not suffering from intellectual overload, and it's going to be given by Steve Clayton on the illusory happiness of the people. Great title.
Yes, socialism and religion. We'll start off with a quick definition. Founding member of the party wrote in 1910. The fundamental idea of religion is a belief in the persistence of life after death. Originally and in essence throughout, religion is a belief in the existence of supernatural beings and the observance of rites and ceremonies in order to avert their anger or gain their goodwill. I mean, religion is one of the forms of spiritual oppression which everywhere weighs down heavily upon the masses of the people. A belief in a better life after death, belief in gods, devils, miracles. We're taught by religion to be submissive and patient while here on earth and to take comfort in the hope of a heavenly reward. Religion is opium for the people. It's a sort of spiritual booze in which the slaves of capital drown their human image. That's actually Lenin, which is just paraphrasing Marx, really. But economic slavery is the true source of the religious fog surrounding humanity.
I've got like a few pictures.
Right, on the Socialist Party website, can anybody see that?
Yeah.
In the A to Z of Marxism entry under religion, it says, "We fight religious superstition wherever it is an obstacle to socialism, but we are opposed to religion only insofar as it is an obstacle to socialism." We have a membership questionnaire for people joining the party. There's some of the 12 questions. And it's the party entrance exam. And one of the questions is, are religious beliefs compatible with socialist understanding? So that's just basically the introduction. And I want to talk about Ludwig Feuerbach. There he is on an East German coin from 1979. Two works I want to look at of Ludwig Feuerbach's are The Essence of Christianity and the Preliminary Theses for the Reform of Philosophy. Feuerbach has a major influence on Marx. He explains religion in naturalistic, historical and social terms. I mean, Engels wrote of the liberating effect of Feuerbach, and Marx wrote of the importance of Feuerbach breaking the spell of the Hegelian system and establishing the truths that human consciousness is the only consciousness that exists and it's dependent upon the physical existence of human beings as part of nature. Marx wrote, "Feuerbach is the only one who has a serious critical attitude to the Hegelian dialectic and who has made genuine discoveries in this field. He is, in fact, the true conqueror of the old philosophy." He also wrote, "There is no other path to truth and freedom except that through the fiery stream." Feuerbach, meaning fiery stream. Marx actually wrote to Feuerbach and said that he actually given socialism a philosophical foundation. Sidney Hook wrote, "If Hegel was the anointed king of German thought in the period from 1820 to 1840, then Feuerbach was the philosophical arch-rebel from the time of the publication of his Essence of Christianity to the eve of the revolution of 1848. One of Ludwig Feuerbach's concepts was species being, which he defined as the essential difference between man and the brute. And it's the fact that man is not only conscious of himself as an individual, as animals are, but also aware of himself as a member of a species, i.e. a species being. So man is in fact once an I and thou. He can put himself in the place of another. For this reason, a competitive society in which the individual and the universal are in conflict is at odds with what is specifically human in man." Feuerbach criticised Hegel as rational mysticism. The mystical, metaphysical fog engulfed Hegel. He was a greater mystification as any theology. So Hegel is seen as the last bulwark of theology. He started from the ideal instead of the real. Although Hegel had dissolved the distinction between God and humanity by regarding human life as a material projection of the divine realm. So there's no distinction between humanity and the divine. The relationship had been stated upside down. So what Feuerbach does, and Marx later, is setting it the right way up. It is the reality of the natural world of which the divine is a projection. So the central theme to Feuerbach is religion is an alienated form of human self-consciousness. For Feuerbach, religious beliefs, God, is an alienated projection of human attributes, desires and potentialities. It's the human species essence, humanity's alter ego. So when humanity makes statements about God, they're actually statements and attributes about human nature, but in a mystified form. So what are in reality human qualities are thus made to appear as a divine power to which humanity aspires, to which they are subject. So we are alienated from our own true being, our own species essence. The predicates that religious believers apply to God are predicates that properly apply to the human species essence, of which God, again, is an imaginary representation. So by worshipping God, people unconsciously are worshipping themselves. It's Spinoza's man is a god to man. So if we transform theological statements about God into naturalistic statements about humanity, it corrects the Hegelian inversion and allows humanity to re-establish its own essential dignity, its species being. So when humanity realises this, they will be in a position to appropriate the attributes for themselves by realising that they had created God, not God them, and thus be in a position to restore to themselves their alienated species being or communal essence. Since Hegel's dialectic started and ended with the infinite, the finite, namely humanity, was only a phase. What Feuerbach's saying is philosophy should start not from God or the absolute, nor even from being as a predicate of the absolute. First, philosophy had to begin with the finite, the particular, the real. This is the reversal of the subject and predicate in the Hegelian dialectic. In Hegel, thought is being, thought is the subject, being the predicate. So Feuerbach would say, we need only to make the predicate into the subject and thus reverse speculative philosophy to arrive at the unconcealed pure truth. The true relationship of thought to being is this. Being is the subject, thought the predicate. Thought arises from being. Being does not arise from thought. That is Feuerbach. So one point central to Feuerbach and thus to Marx is that Hegel had reversed the correct relation of subjects and predicates. The inversion principle allowed Marx to put Hegel's dialectic onto its feet. Marx characterised the Hegelian dialectic as standing on its head. The mystification which dialectic suffers in Hegel's hands by no means prevents him from being the first to present its general form of working in a comprehensive and conscious manner. With him, it is standing on its head. It must be turned right side up again if you would discover the rational kernel within the mystical shell. So an all-wise God is an inverted projection of human poverty. The more empty life is, the fuller, the more concrete is God. So the impoverishing of the real world and the enriching of God is one act. Humanity created God in its own image and then treated itself as a dependent on its own creation. So by exposing the mystified nature of religion, the alienated subject-object relation can be reversed. God brought down to earth and humanity made whole. So humanity and social humanity in its rightful place at the centre of things. The 1848 revolution and its failure was a huge disappointment to Feuerbach, and he sort of like drifted away into obscurity. But in 1870, he actually read Marx's Capital, and he joined the German Social Democratic Workers' Party, which led Engels to write, "The German working class movement is the heir to classical German philosophy." Eugene Kamenka said, "An understanding of Feuerbach's earlier works form an indispensable precondition for appreciating Marx's aims and methods." I just want to quickly look at Marx's short work on the Jewish question, which is a response to Bruno Bauer's The Jewish Question, where Bruno Bauer had said religious prejudice and separation would vanish when civil and political castes and prejudices were done away with and all men enjoyed equal rights in a liberal secular state. For Marx, though, political emancipation is a poor substitute because it falls short of real human freedom. I mean, the political status of a citizen is illusory. Real inequalities are rooted in the economic order in private or civil society, which the state upholds. Mere secularisation of politics did not entail emancipation of men and women as human beings. So the separation of the state from civil society still meant the failure of liberal politics to solve social questions. So religious inequalities are not the result of social inequalities, they're merely their symptom. Bauer mistakes political emancipation for human emancipation. I mean, freedom of religion is one of the fundamental tenets of bourgeois liberalism. I mean, Marx, before he wrote his essay, had been reading about France and the USA, where he pointed out it's possible to be emancipated politically without being emancipated from religion. I mean, in the USA, for example, then and as is now, there's no established religion, but it's notorious, the country is notorious for the religiosity of its people. I mean, the First Amendment of the US Constitution states, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. However, separation of the church, religion and the state is not extended to bar religious conduct in public places or by public servants. So America is bourgeois political emancipation, but not emancipation from religion. I mean, Marx wrote, North America is the land of religiosity par excellence. When we see in the very country of complete political emancipation, not only that religion exists, but retains its vigour, there is no need, I hope, for other proofs in order to show that the existence of religion is not incompatible with the full political maturity of the state. But if religion exists, it is because of a defective social organisation of which it is necessary to seek the cause. Again, it's the same with the French Great Bourgeois Revolution of 1789, Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen. No one may be disturbed on account of his opinions, even religious ones, as long as the manifestation of such opinions does not interfere with the established law and order. I mean, the bourgeois liberal triumph in France came in 1905 with laïcité, the word derives from laity, i.e. not clergy, and it translates as secularity, the separation of church and state, the freedom of public institutions from the influence of the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, religious emancipation gives freedom of religion, but it does not give freedom from the rule of religion, property or trade. For Marx, socialism, human emancipation, the emancipation of humanity in all its faculties, society cannot be cured of its ills simply by emancipating the political sphere from religious influence. It's still the capitalist economic system. I mean, Marx makes use of Feuerbach's term species being as a key characteristic of humanity. For Feuerbach, it refers to human consciousness of a human essence in everybody. But Marx stresses more strongly the social basis of this consciousness and the need to realise the potential of it in action by humanity as a social being. I mean, I think comrades will be aware of Marx's famous introduction to a critique of Hegel's philosophy of right, because that is where he actually states his main beliefs about religion. I mean, Marx says religion is a fantasy of alienated humanity. It's the most extreme form of alienation. It supplies a model for criticism of other forms of alienation. He wrote, "The criticism of religion is the premise of all criticism. The criticism of heaven turns into the criticism of earth, the criticism of religion into the criticism of law, and the criticism of theology into the criticism of politics." So religion is a symptom of a deep social malaise and a protest against it, but it still stands in the way of any cure of social evil. Religion is a false, it's an inverted consciousness. Religion sees the real world, it feels the real world, it sorrows over the real world, but it does all this upside down. Religion descends from heaven to earth. That's from the German ideology. But it also disempowers protest, because the more man puts into God, the less he retains within himself. So religion is only the illusory sun which revolves around man, as long as he does not revolve around himself. Religion is an act of protest against suffering, an act of opposition to all that degrades and denies us. But religion is also both a suffering and a crying out against that suffering. Humanity seeks solace and an end to their suffering. In Marx's words, religious suffering is at one and the same time the expression of real suffering and a protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. So religion resolves itself into an explanation of that suffering through dogma, and religious ritual, you know, practice. And this makes the suffering sufferable. So like an opiate, it covers over the suffering without actually removing it. It is the opium of the people. The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is the demand for their real happiness, full human emancipation in socio-economic terms. It is therefore the task of history, once the other world of truth has vanished, to establish the truth of this world. Man makes religion, religion does not make man. State and this society produce religion, which is an inverted consciousness of the world, because they are an inverted world. religion is the fantastic realization of the human essence, since the human essence has not acquired any true reality. The struggle against religion is therefore indirectly the struggle against that world whose spiritual aroma is religion. Religion in itself is without content. It owes its being not to heaven, but to earth. And with the abolition of distorted reality, of which it is a theory, it will collapse of itself. So abolishing class society will lead to an end to religion. The struggle against religion cannot be separated from the struggle for socialism. Well, one of the main problems with Feuerbach's approach to alienation, this is Marx's criticism of Feuerbach, was that it went no further than inverting the idealism of Hegel, transferring the alienation from the sphere of the spirit to that of human beings. For Feuerbach, man remained a sort of nebulous concept as much as human nature or species being. So human beings are not being placed in concrete circumstances, you know, a secular basis, class society, for example. The human essence is a purely sort of abstract category. Marx wrote, "The essence of man is no abstraction inherent in each single individual. In it, reality, it is the ensemble of social relations." Marx and Engels in the German Ideology wrote, "German philosophy, which descends from heaven to earth, here we ascend from earth to heaven. That is to say, we do not set out from what men say, imagine, conceive, nor from men as narrated, thought of, imagined, conceived, in order to arrive at men in the flesh. We set out from real, active men. Morality, religion, metaphysics, all the rest of ideology and their corresponding forms of consciousness thus no longer retain the semblance of independence. Life is not determined by consciousness, but consciousness by life," which is Marx, which is basically Feuerbach. The true relation to thought to being is this: thought arises from being, being does not arise from thought. Feuerbach did not grasp the sensuous world around him. It's not a thing given direct from all eternity. It remains the same, ever the same, but is the product of industry and the state of society. I mean, in his theses on Feuerbach, he puts it into a nutshell that the chief defect of all hitherto existing materialism, that of Feuerbach included, is that the thing, reality, sensuousness, is conceived only in the form of the object or of contemplation, but not as sensuous human activity, practice, not subjectively. I mean, thesis number 7, he says, Feuerbach consequently does not see that the religious sentiment is itself a social product, and that the abstract individual, which he analyses, belongs to a particular form of society. So for Marx, the aim is to keep human consciousness tightly and critically focused upon this world. The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways, i.e. Feuerbach, but the point is to change it. Let's have a quick look about the origin of religion. I mean, it's based on ignorance, fear. I mean, when man and women, at the beginning of the dawn of society history, were ignorant, fear, they're unable to know the meaning of things, you know, so supernatural, spirits, the dead, lack of control over nature, the death, loss of consciousness, hallucination, insanity, trances, dreams, the powers of the weather. I mean, religion was the outcome of man's ignorance of nature's working. So religion has a natural, not a supernatural origin. And in contact with nature, humanity faced with questions, you know, it was faced with questions like, you know, our shadow, our reflection in the water, echoes, dreams. They all sort of demand an explanation. I mean, dreams are not a fantastic product of the mind. They are real experiences to them. Marx and Engels in the German Ideology wrote, "Natural religion is the consciousness of nature, which first confronts me as completely alien, all-powerful and unassailable." So the first religious impulse stemmed from the need to mollify the natural forces on which the very continued existence of humanity depended. One of our party pamphlets is How the Gods Were Made, written by John Caracha. And here's a little, it's like a really nice little vignette in there, where he talks about Native American culture and their idea of heaven, the happy hunting ground. I mean, this pins it right down, religion is of natural, not supernatural origin. I mean, a Native American would dream of a long hunting trip in a beautiful hunting ground with a ground well stocked with game. And this basically is created out of the material environment in which the Native American lives. So they make their own heaven after the earthly existence that they've got. So they would, in their heaven, they would hunt and fish amid beautiful valleys with rushing waters and rugged mountains, or on plains teeming with buffalo, deer and other wild animals. So the happy hunting ground is simply the earthly surroundings cast upward. I just want to look at briefly at the rise of Christianity, and I've used three sources for this. Kolkowski's Foundations of Christianity, the Socialist Party's Socialism and Religion pamphlet from 1910, and also Engels' late work on the history of early Christianity. I mean, Christianity arises out of the decay of the Roman Empire. The peasant producer had been steadily crushed by the growth of large estates worked by slave labour. Taxation plunged the peasants into ever deeper bondage to the usurers. So there was agricultural exhaustion of the Italian provinces, increasing wealth inequalities, and also a concentration of political power into the hands of an individual, the emperor. This killed all political life and thought for the mass of the people, and it led to the decay of the social sentiment and turned people's thoughts to individual matters, which is in preparation to accept the Christian notion of the individual being, being solely concerned with his or her own salvation and intent on making his or her own peace with God. I mean, the political and physical disasters led to despair, especially to the slaves, and it drove them to religion for consolation. Seeley wrote, "The age was religious because it was an age of servitude. Resistance to Roman world power was deemed hopeless. So salvation for the enslaved, emancipated slaves, oppressed and impoverished free men was not going to be in this world. It would be a religious way out, a new world, a continued life of the soul after the death of the body. So heaven and hell is created as a way out for workers and slaves from this veil of woe to eternal paradise." Early Christianity practiced a form of anarchist communism. There's a couple of quotes now. I'm going to be quoting from the New Testament. Acts 2, verse 44, all the believers were together and had everything in common. And again, Acts 4, 32 to 35 states, all the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything they had. There were no needy persons among them. For from time to time, those who owned land or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone who had need. I mean, Engels quotes the Roman satirist Lucian, the Voltaire of classical antiquity. He said, "They despise all material goods without distinction and own them in common." What developed from the early Christianity was the development of the priesthood. You know, and the teachings of Christianity were turned from that of a rebellious character into one that was actually more servile. For Christian anarchists, for example, Paul is deemed as the church deviation from Jesus' original teachings. So the degeneration of Christianity became paramount when it became the state religion of the Roman Empire in the 4th century AD. This is known as the Constantinian shift. An ethic of submission produced a complete change in the attitude of the people to the emperor. It made their loyalty more intense. That's another quote from Seeley. Sorry, I didn't preface that. It has to be noted, though, that the material conditions that existed 2,000 years ago did not allow for any idea of a transformation of society towards socialism. Also, interestingly, Constantine the Great, who made religion the state, Christianity the state religion of the Roman Empire, also introduced bond service, which restricted rights of peasant tenant farmers and tied them to estates. This is the beginnings of serfdom, the basis of feudalism, where new higher relations of production were already gestating in the womb of the old society. This is Thomas Munzer, Omnia Sunt Communia. He was a German a priest in the 16th century who led the a peasant's war against the nobles and the landlords. In the 16th century, peasants had a different economic interest to the rising bourgeoisie. They wanted a more radical Protestantism, and they protested against the church and landlords, and they protested against the holding of any property whatsoever. They said that it should be held in common. In his 8th article of confession under torture before execution, Thomas Munzer stated, "It was their article of belief and they wanted to establish this principle. All property should be held in common and should be distributed each according to their needs as the occasion required." I mean, Engels in his The Peasant War in Germany wrote, "The revolutionary opposition to feudalism was alive throughout the Middle Ages. According to conditions of the time, it appeared either in the form of mysticism, as open heresy, or of armed insurrection. As mysticism, it is well known how indispensable it was for the reformers of the 16th century. Munzer himself was largely indebted to it." I mean, the peasant uprising was crushed by the rising capitalists and landlords and aristocracy. I mean, Munzer's personal belief about the kingdom of God differed from Luther's. Engels wrote that he believed in a society with no class differences, no private property, and no state authority, independent of and foreign to members of society. So the rise of capitalism, I mean, economic forces began to undermine feudal society and the feudal power that was the church. I mean, the real social world had changed. Its religious reflex had to follow. So Protestantism was a result of developing capitalism and was its ideological justification. The new class of merchants, traders and artisans, city dwellers, they were outside the towns, the kings and aristocrats held sway, and they taxed the industrious and thrifty burghers. The early capitalists protested to the church, but its economic roots in land ownership, owning nearly one-third of the entire land of Europe, sided with the kings and aristocracy against the rising capitalists. So the Lutheran Reformation in Germany was the triumph of the new class. It was the adoption of Christianity to the economic needs of the bourgeoisie. So Lutheranism evolved with the developing capitalist system until it expressed the social needs of full-blown capitalism. So the Reformation, though wearing a religious cloak, was a terrific class struggle. It was fought for material interests. Capitalism got a freer hand, and the aristocrats had to take a secondary position or be wiped out entirely as a class, as was their fate in the French Revolution. So Protestantism is the form Christianity takes under capitalism. It serves to give a holy tinge to the robbery of wage slaves. I mean, whereas slavery is vile and unchristian, serfdom likewise, but wage slavery is all right. As you see, I'm going in sort of like a chronological order. Gerard Winstanley, the diggers, you know, the true levellers. I mean, Winstanley was sympathetic to the levellers, but he did not want peasant ownership. He wanted community life, by which he meant both teamwork and eating at the common table. His new law of righteousness from 1648, he found a basis for his beliefs from the New Testament. I'm going to quote the New Testament again, Acts 2, verses 44 to 45. "All who believed were together and had all things in common. They would sell their possessions and goods and distribute the proceeds to all, as any had need." I mean, for Winstanley, in the beginning of time, God made the earth. Not one word was spoken at the beginning that one branch should rule over another. In 1652, in his The Law of Freedom, Winstanley laid the foundations for a communist commonwealth, a classless society, advocating an economy without money, organised around public storehouses to which each would bring the product of his or her labour and from which each could satisfy his or her needs. For Winstanley, the source of all exploitation was private property. He wrote, "Labour is the source of all wealth, and no man ever grew rich save by appropriating the fruits of others' work." So exploitation was the source of all oppression and war. Economic inequality degrades those who must submit to it. He wrote, "God is within yourself and in every man. He that looks for God outside himself and worships God at a distance worships he knows not what." Winstanley actually identified organised religion as an instrument of the ruling class. He wrote, "Religion is made a cloak of policy by the subtle elder brother to cheat his simple younger brother of the freedoms of the earth. For saith the elder brother, the earth is mine and not yours, brother. You must therefore not work upon it unless you will hire it from me, and you must not take the fruits of it unless you will buy them from me, by which I pay for your labour. For if you should do otherwise, God will not love you, and you shall not go to heaven when you die." I mean, Winstanley held that the earth had originally been given to mankind by God to be held in common, and that landlords were usurpers. I mean, common ownership necessarily involves the disappearance of buying and selling and of money, and this can be seen in Winstanley. He wrote, "The earth is to be planted and the fruits reaped and carried into barns and storehouses by the assistance of every family. And if any man or woman, any man or family want corn or other provision, they may go to the storehouses and fetch without money. And the reason why all the riches of the earth are common stock is this, because the earth and the labours thereupon are managed by common assistance of every family, without buying and selling." as Leo Tolstoy, a famous author and Christian anarchist. In his novel Anna Karenina, he wrote, "You know that capitalism oppresses the workers. Our workmen, the peasants, bear the whole burden of labour. All the profits on their labour, all this surplus value, is taken away by the capitalists." In his short work, What Shall We Do Then?, Tolstoy wrote, "Money is the new form of slavery. The essence of all slavery consists in drawing the benefit of another's labour force by compulsion, and it is founded upon property in the slave or upon property in money." In his work, The Kingdom of God is Within You, he takes the title from Luke 17, verse 21, where it's written, "No one will say, 'Look, here it is,' or 'There it is,' because the kingdom of God is within you." For Tolstoy, how can you kill people when it is written in God's commandment, "Thou shalt not murder"? So all governments who wage war are an affront to Christian principles. He had an opposition to organised religion. He wrote, "Christianity, in its true significance, abolishes the state. It annihilates all governments. Revolutionary enemies fight the government from outside. Christianity does not fight at all, but wrecks its foundation from within." I mean, Tolstoy recognised that grand gestures of charity would not make a dent in the problem, because the problem is rooted in the whole system of property ownership and money, and it backed up by the tyranny of the state machine, which Tolstoy said must be abolished. This social order, with its pauperism, famines, prisons, gallows, armies and wars, he wrote. He saw church doctrine as a perversion of Jesus' teachings. He opposed private property. All governments who wage war and churches who support these governments are an affront to what he saw as Christian principles of non-violence. So his sort of Christianity was a Christianity without mysticism. It's Jesus as teacher, not God incarnate. It's sort of a humanised religion. We seek the kingdom of God not without, but within ourselves, which is close to Gerard Winstanley, who I spoke about earlier. So for Tolstoy, the state exists to guarantee the perpetuation of property relationships. He proposed cooperative production, distribution on communistic principles. Even Kropotkin, in his article on anarchism in the Encyclopaedia Britannica, wrote of Tolstoy, "Without naming himself an anarchist, Leo Tolstoy, like his predecessors in the popular religious movements of the 15th and 16th centuries, took the anarchist position as regards the state and property rights, deducing his conclusions from the general spirit of the teachings of Jesus and from necessary dictates of reason. With all the might of his talent, he made a powerful criticism of the church, the state, and law altogether, and especially of the present property laws. He describes the state as the domination of the wicked ones supported by brutal force." I mean, Tolstoy is a huge influence on the Roman Catholic group, Catholic Worker Movement, which was established in 1933 in the USA. I mean, they used to still have, I believe, communities, houses of hospitality for the poor. There was one such house in Salt Lake City. It was known as the Joe Hill House of Hospitality, and that existed until about 1968. And I haven't seen a picture of this, but it actually featured an enormous 12 by 15 foot mural of Jesus and Joe Hill. If anybody can find that image for me, I'd really appreciate that. I couldn't find it anywhere on the internet. That's a mural in a South American country. I want to talk about liberation theology, which, you know, comrades will have heard about, which was very popular in sort of like South America and Central America in the sort of 70s and into the 80s. But first of all, again, was Jesus a socialist? I mean, we say in our religion, this is the last refuge of the confusionist and mystery monger. And again, I'll say the material conditions that existed 2,000 years ago did not allow any idea of a transformation of society towards socialism. So, liberation theology, I mean, at its roots in a movement in Roman Catholic Church in the 1960s called Vatican II, which was like a conclave of ideas from 1962 to 65. I mean, one of the documents that was produced by this Vatican II was, "While an immense number of people still lack the absolute necessities of life, some, even in less advanced areas, live in luxury or squander wealth. Extravagance and wretchedness exist side by side. While a few enjoy very great power of choice, the majority are deprived of almost all possibility of acting on their own initiative and responsibility, and often subsist in living and working conditions unworthy of the human person." This was followed later by a sort of papal circular, I think in 1967, which quotes St. Ambrose, and it says, as St. Ambrose put it, you are not making a gift of what is yours to the poor man, but you are giving him back what is his. You have been appropriating things that are meant to be for the common use of everyone. The earth belongs to everyone, not to the rich. I mean, these words indicate that the right to private property is not absolute and unconditional. So no one may appropriate surplus goods solely for his own private use when others lack the bare necessities of life. In short, as the fathers of the church and other eminent theologians tell us, the right of private property may never be exercised to the detriment of the common good. That's a papal circular in 1967. The Wall Street Journal was horrified by that, actually called it warmed over Marxism. But liberation theology stems from these ideas in the Roman Catholic Church in the 1960s. I mean, it's a theological movement, but it draws on Kant, Hegel, and Marx. From Kant, it drew on the autonomy of human reason. The revelation from outside is replaced by the revelation of God found in the matrix of human interaction with history. Hegel's Lord Bondsman dialectic, showing the liberation of humankind. And from Marx, humanity's wholeness can be realised only through overcoming the alienating political and economic structures of society. I mean, liberation theologians really like Marx's statement, hitherto philosophers have interpreted the world, our task is to change it. I mean, they argue that theologians are not meant to be theoreticians, but practitioners engaged in the struggle to bring about society's transformation. I mean, in order to do this, liberation theology employs a Marxist-style class analysis. There was a social reorganisation of the church, the model of Christian-based communities, a sort of a bottom-up practice, the interpreted biblical teachings from the perspective of the poor and disadvantaged. And they acknowledged the failure of capitalism, and that capitalism favours the privileged. They identified the Catholic Church hierarchy as members of the bourgeois class, oppressing the indigenous people since the time of Pizarro, and supporting military juntas propped up by US capitalism. I should have put that up earlier. The major work is A Theology of Liberation by Gustavo Gutierrez from 1971. The influence of Marxist thought, again, is in his book. It focuses on praxis and is geared to the transformation of the world. Again, the philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it. Gutierrez appreciates a Marxist thesis on Feuerbach, you know, the transforming capacity of human nature. I mean, he wrote, only a class analysis has to be put within the framework of the worldwide class struggle. He denounces as insufficient, those partial and limited measures which amount only to palliatives and in the long run actually consolidate an exploitative system. So the problems are rooted in the structures of capitalist society. It is necessary to change the very basis of the system, which is a far-reaching transformation of existent structures. I mean, I've got quotes from Colombian priests or Mexican churchmen here, and they talk about building a socialist type of society, or a socialist system is more in accord with the Christian principles of true fellowship, justice and peace. They define capitalism as inhuman and anti-Christian. Ernest Bloch is a writer in the 1950s. He wrote a book called The Hope Principle. And again, he actually makes use of this as a point of departure for his whole thesis. The chief defect of all hitherto existing materialism, that of Feuerbach concluded, is that the thing, reality, sensuousness, is conceived only in the form of the object or a contemplation. Again, liberation theology is located in the concrete and sensuousness of the world. But as we pointed out, though, the poor are social and economic connotations, but it's not the proletariat. I mean, liberation theology has been criticised as being utopian socialism or just sort of Christianised Marxism. I mean, today, we see a religious resurgence all around the world. I mean, in Muslim communities, there's the new veiling, which is a return to more traditional conservative values. Fundamentalist Christianity is powerful in the USA. We've got Pentecostalism in Africa. Saudi Arabia's puritanical Wahhabism. There's fundamentalist jihadist Islam in the Middle East. I mean, Christianity is also making great strides in China. I mean, this religious resurgence really is based really on the post-Soviet collapse, you know, when the failure of Leninism and African nationalism, globalization, the free market, Western capitalism and its global hegemony, there's a general swing towards conservatism in an uncertain, anarchic capitalist world. So as society becomes more complex, religion explains social forces. Religion is the ideological product of the changing economic and social conditions. It's a reflection of people's lack of control over the conditions governing the production of their material means of survival, and that it survives precisely because people lack control over their lives. I want to talk about the religious working class and the party, you know, like a socialist party. I mean, Marx and Engels wrote in the German Ideology, the ideas of the ruling class, or in every epoch, the ruling ideas, i.e. the class which is the ruling material force of society, is at the same time its ruling intellectual force. The class which has the means of material production at its disposal has control at the same time over the means of mental production. So the most important function of ideologists, the mental labourers, is to elaborate ideas that ratify, propagate, defend and naturalise the status quo, securing the property and power of the capitalist class. I mean, religion plays a vital role as an ideological bulwark of the ruling class in every class society. Modern religions and churches, religious organisations, are instruments of bourgeois reaction that serve to defend exploitation and to befuddle the working class. I mean, capitalism leaves room for religion because it maintains ignorance and confusion by its structure and contradictions, because religion is used as a means to class domination. So the fog of religion, the religious bamboozling of the workers, is used against the socialist movement by the capitalist class. It cloaks the hideousness and injustice of capitalism and keeps the exploited meek and submitted and submissive. And a quote from Marx, the social principles of Christianity justified the slavery of antiquity. It glorifies the serfdom of the Middle Ages and are capable, in case of need, of defending the oppression of the proletariat with somewhat doleful grimaces. The social principles of Christianity preach the necessity of a ruling and an oppressed class, and for the latter, all they have to offer is the pious wish that the former may be charitable. I mean, efforts should be made to rescue the religious working class from their barbarous beliefs. I mean, like Marx wrote, the tradition of past generation weighs like an Alp upon the brain of the living. I mean, the working class carry many traditions, religious ideas that belong with the past, beliefs that arose out of the economic and material conditions that have long since passed away due to capitalist education. I want to quote Lenin now. There he is, the master from Doctor Who. So I mixed up my files there. Oh, there's Mrs. Lenin, Natasha Kinsky, I think. For Lenin on religion, he wrote two short pieces, you know, in the early 1900s. One was The Attitude of the Workers' Party to Religion, and another one was called Socialism and Religion. And he wrote, we do not prohibit proletarians who still retain vestiges of their old prejudices from associating themselves with our party. Religion must be declared a private affair so far as the state is concerned, but by no means can we consider religion a private affair as far as our party is concerned. Our party is an association of class-conscious, advanced fighters for the emancipation of the working class. Such an association cannot be indifferent to lack of class consciousness, ignorance or obscurantism in the shape of religious beliefs. He went on to say, we do not and should not set forth our atheism in our programme. So he poses explicit proclamations of atheism, declaring war on religion, for example, as he says that's the best way to revive interest in religion. It's, as Engels says, it's to out-Bismarck Bismarck, who in the 1870s passed laws against the Roman Catholic Church, but actually led to an increase in the political power of the Catholic Church. So basically, Lenin would say atheist propaganda must be subordinated to its basic task, the development of the class struggle of the exploited masses against the exploiters. So the main aim of our struggle is emancipation from wage slavery. Interestingly, Lenin was asked whether a priest can be a member of the party, and he said yes. He said, if a priest comes to us to take part in our common political work and conscientiously performs party duties without opposing the programme of the party, he may be allowed to join the ranks of the Social Democrats. For the contradiction between the spirit and principles of our programme and the religious convictions of the priest would in such circumstances be something that concerned him alone, his own private contradiction. And a political organisation cannot put its members through an examination to see if there's no contradiction between their views and the party programme. I've put that in highlighted time. I mean, so a priest could join, the Workers' Party, but if he made it his chief sole task to actually propagate his religious views in the party, then he would obviously be expelled. I found this in an August 1906 Socialist Standard. Sorry about the quality of that. In August 1906, the Socialist Standard, somebody wrote into the party. Well, it was a writer in the South London Mail. He said a young man on Clapham Common said he'd endeavoured to become a member of the SPGB, but in consequence of his being a Christian, he was refused admission. But the Social Standard replies, this is a case where the writer, if he desires to do us justice, should produce his young man. There are no religious tests applied to candidates for membership of this party. All that is asked of them is their signature to our Declaration of Principles, after which their conduct must be in strict accordance therewith, or they must leave the party. I'm just going to talk about secularism or atheism. It's Charles Bradlaugh and Richard Dawkins there. They're the same guy, really. They're just separated by 100 years, really. I mean, secularism or atheism, secularism is a reformist movement. It's dedicated to the task of the separation of religion from the state by means of legislation. I mean, what we say is that rationalism puts the cart before the horse. Religion is the product of the social environment and will disappear only when its social causes disappear. So the movement has always been a stalwart defender of capitalism. I mean, the first big debate of the Social Democratic Federation in 1884 was against Charles Bradlaugh. I mean, he was described as the high priest of the atheists, the professional atheist, the bishop of atheism. Heinemann called him the individualist of individualists. I mean, he was a bourgeois liberal reformist. He believed in laissez-faire capitalism, radical Victorian self-help, self-improvement ethos of individualism. He was an anti-socialist. He denounced the defeated communards of the Paris Commune. He admired and supported Thiers and the French Third Republic. He actually attacked Marx for his address on the Civil War in France. And he saw no intrinsic conflict between capital and labour. And he was against trade unions. He's also anti-working class in the fact that he was actually a neo-Malthusian. You know, he actually believed helping poor parents to feed their children would only encourage them to overbreed. So poverty was due to working class insistence on having large families. So what I'm saying is that our enemy's enemy is not necessarily our friend. I mean, modern atheism is really propagated by this gentleman here, Richard Dawkins, evolutionary biologist, Darwinian. I mean, he treats religious belief as a blind spot from lack of education. And then, therefore, if everybody's educated, all religious conflicts, wars, AIDS, everything else would be abolished. So spreading atheism is his priority. I mean, his political beliefs are suspect as well. I mean, he officially endorsed the Liberal Democrats in their support of their campaign for electoral reform and their refusal to pander to faith at the 2010 general election. But he's a eugenicist as well. So he believes in improving the genetic quality of the human population. I mean, through the promotion of higher reproduction of people with desired traits and reduced reproduction of people with undesired traits. He's also an advocate of euthanasia. I mean, recently he said something about, he said choosing not to abort a child with Down syndrome would be uncivilized and immoral, which is another way of saying it is our moral duty to kill those with Down syndrome. I mean, he advocates that we need to disassociate eugenics from Hitler and Nazism. I mean, he thinks the dark history of eugenics is something that is over and done with now and we can forget about it and get on. So, again, like Bradlaugh, he's a Malthusian, believes in population control. I mean, I won't talk about Malthus, I'll leave this out like that. But basically, he's using social media, Dawkins, to get people to climatise to the idea that eugenics already exists and it's not that bad. I mean, he's actually an activist and he's writing for the general public. I mean, he supports capitalism and he's doing the dirty work for capitalism. I mean, back to Feuerbach and Marx, about atheism. And Feuerbach wrote, I deny God, but that means to me that I deny the negation of man. In place of the illusory, fantastic, heavenly position of man, which in actual life necessarily leads to the degradation of man, I substitute the tangible, actual, and consequently also the political and social position of mankind. The question concerning the existence or non-existence of God is, for me, nothing but the question concerning the existence or non-existence of man. Which actually finds its echo in Marx, because Marx wrote in the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts, atheism is a negation of God and postulates the existence of man through this negation. But socialism, as socialism, no longer stands in need of such a mediation. It proceeds from the theoretically and practically sensuous consciousness of man and of nature as the essence. Socialism is man's positive self-consciousness, no longer mediated through the abolition of religion. So for Marx, the term atheism becomes devoid of any meaning, for it is no longer necessary to deny something in order to affirm humanity. Socialism simply starts with humanity and nature. Back to the SPGB, and at the 1908 Socialist Party conference, it was declared that active Christianity was incompatible with active participation in the socialist movement, although a membership test was deemed unnecessary and undesirable at that time. The pamphlet Socialism and Religion, some reproduction of it here, written in July 1910 by a founder member, and it's basically a review of the Marxist theory of religion, origins and history, and of the necessity for a materialist viewpoint as the groundwork for socialist thinking. In the Socialist Standard of August 1910, reasons for the crackdown on religion are the sucking up to the professional propagandists of superstition by Labour leaders as a vote-catching scheme. There was an increase in activity at this time of Christian socialists, I put socialists in inverted commas there. A church socialist league was formed in the Anglican Church in 1906, and it had 1,200 members in 35 branches by 1909. So the party's religious policy was for the practical reason of opposing Christian socialism. Marx and Engels described Christian socialism as the holy water with which the priest consecrates the heart burnings of the aristocrat. Here's a picture of a Christian socialist. Ramsay MacDonald exhibiting some muscular Christianity, I think. Ramsay MacDonald wrote, "The socialist finds in the ethics of the Gospels a marvellous support for his economic and political proposals." I mean, Keir Hardie said, "I first learned my socialism in the New Testament." So basically, those reforms are, it's all reforms instead of revolution, a regulated capitalism rather than its abolition. I found something in the archives, a little pamphlet called The Rebel and His Disciples from 1912. It was written by a Guy Aldred. He was actually a boy preacher of Christianity in London in 1902 when he was about 15 years of age. He would actually briefly join the SDF. He then became an atheist and then an anarchist, and he founded the Bakunin Press. But in his pamphlet, The Rebel and His Disciples, he calls Jesus the Anarch of Calvary of Gethsemane. He wrote, "The rebellious significance of Jesus, the eternal ethic of humanism and revolt." So he goes on to say, "In paying homage to the memory of Jesus, we turn our backs on kings and priests, on pomp and ceremony, and cant and salute the common people. These are the sustainers of genius, the creators of wealth, the lovers of truth. Let our atheist, anarchist and communist toast be given to Jesus and the common people, comrades." He's very eccentric. Today, Christian socialists, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, they're open, avowed supporters of capitalism. Be pleased to hear, I'm nearly finished. So do we need atheism? I want to quote Marx. "Socialism is man's positive self-consciousness, no longer mediated through the abolition of religion." Secularism and atheism are not necessarily friends of socialism and the working class. Are religious beliefs compatible with socialist understanding? I've looked at Munzer, Winstanley, Tolstoy, Christian anarchism, liberation theology. To quote Lenin again, "We do not prohibit workers who still retain vestiges of their old prejudices from associating themselves with our party, but surely better in so that they can receive a thorough Marxian education." We say we fight religious superstition wherever it is an obstacle to socialism, but we are opposed to religion only insofar as it is an obstacle to socialism. Christian socialism is not the enemy it was. The enemy, as always, is capitalism. Marx wrote in Capital, "The religious reflex of the real world can, in any case, only then finally vanish when the practical relations of everyday life offer to man none but perfectly intelligible and reasonable relations with regard to his fellow man, men and nature." Britain is not a secular country. Religion has not been removed from the political discourse. Politicians bend over backwards to placate and respect organised religions. Bourgeois society is coloured by religion. This is a quote from Bukharin in his ABC of Communism. He saw the reconciliation of the bourgeoisie with the church finds expression not merely in the abandonment by the bourgeoisie of its old anti-religious watchwords and of its campaign against religion. I mean, if the bourgeois class begins to believe in God and the heavenly life, this merely means it has realised that its life here, below, is drawing to a close. Thank you.